Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy on KFI is provided by DSL Extreme at dslextreme.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is the Tech Guy Show. This show originally aired on Saturday, March 3rd, 2007. This is show 331.
Europe.
The Tech Guy is brought to you by my internet service provider, DSL Extreme. Call 866, the number 2, GetNet online at dslextreme.com. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Wherever you are, anywhere in the globe, around the world, I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, coming to you from the Tech Guy Labs, high atop Silicon Valley, looking down upon all the grand businesses like Google and Yahoo. The northernmost part of Silicon Valley. This is a show where we talk about that stuff, tech, not just computers. No, no. Oh, no. When I started doing this 15 years ago, it was 1990, I guess 17 years ago. Oh, my goodness. It was just computers. It was Windows 3.0, it was DOS 6, and that was pretty much it. There certainly wasn't any internet to speak of at the time. Not unless you were a college student or a college professor. We didn't have PDAs. We barely had cell phones. Well, that's changed. Now it's HDTVs, it's cell phones, it's iPods, MP3 players, all of that stuff. That's what we talk about on the show. If you want to join the fun, 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number, toll free from anywhere. Well, almost anywhere in North America. I don't know, actually. I should probably look that up. Certainly the United States. If you're listening in Canada, try and see. 8888 Ask Leo. That's 888-827-5536. And actually, I have to thank a listener who suggested that I say 8888 Ask Leo. Cameron Gray sent me an email saying, you know, it'd be easier to remember. That's probably true, although it's a little confusing to hear a phone number expressed that way, isn't it? 8888 Ask Leo. But it works. What do we talk about? Again, anything with a chip in it. Or, you know, I like to talk about space and stuff like that, too. For instance, tonight, they're saying it'll be the best lunar eclipse in years, visible over the Eastern Americas, Europe, Africa, Asia, and Western Australia. It'll begin at 2018 Greenwich Mean Time, which, if you subtract 5 hours, is 3:30 in the afternoon on the East Coast, or 3:20 in the afternoon on the East Coast. But the full eclipse will happen at 22:44 Greenwich Mean Time, which is about 7 or 8 in the evening, something like that, isn't it? My weak math skills are showing up tonight. Now I've got a question for you. I was getting my coffee this morning. That delicious Mexican chocolate mocha. And I'm standing there, and we were talking about the upcoming lunar eclipse tonight. And a patron, a fella, said, well, wait a minute. Now, I don't understand. What is the difference between a lunar eclipse and a new moon when the moon's just dark? There's a little stumper for you. What's the difference between a lunar eclipse, which we're having tonight, and it's rare, it don't happen very often, and just, you know, when the moon's dark? Think about it for a second. Now, I was standing at a coffee bar, so I couldn't run to Wikipedia, which is what I would have done. So I actually had to think about it. And I'm curious what your process is. Do you try to figure it out? There's probably three different ways you could handle this. Maybe more. Well, let's say four. The first way, and many people will do this, is, I don't know. And that's it. You're done. I don't know. I don't know. Don't ask me. I don't know. That's probably 80% of the population. I bet a lot of the people who listen to this show, though, fall in the group, the subsequent groups, where they want to figure it out. That's kind of what makes you the kind of person that would listen to a show like this. You're kind of curious, right? You want to know. That's a good question. What is the difference between a lunar eclipse and just a new moon, a dark moon? It looks different. So then the next group of people try to puzzle it out in their brain. Abstract types. That's what I was doing. I was thinking, well, wait a minute now. I puzzled it out. Third group of people will actually take coffee cups, chocolate shakers, salt and pepper shakers, and start maneuvering, moving, and often out loud, talking out loud. Well, let's see. There's the sun. There's the earth. There's the moon. Now, a new moon is this, and an eclipse would be, And then there's the fourth group, and I bet you a lot of you fall in this group. You don't think. You don't pause. You open your browser, and you type in the Google bar, lunar eclipse, or you go to Wikipedia. How many of you are in that? I call that Google-assisted memory. This is something that, as I age, I'm relying on more and more. Well, it's actually perfect because it's not just me aging. It's the internet improving and Google and all of that stuff. To the point, and it's perfect because as I get dumber, Google gets smarter. So it's just right. You know, we're at the intersection where they cross. Very frequently now, I can't remember. See if you're in this boat. I can't, you know, I'll see a movie and I go, oh, he was great. What was that other movie he was in? Chris Cooper, I do that with all the time. He's in the new movie Breach. Wonderful actor. Love him. But he's a character actor. You know, you recognize him immediately. You go, what else was he in? Now, what do you do when that happens? I'll tell you what I do. I go to my browser. I type in IMDb, the Internet Movie Database.com. Search for Chris Cooper. And there's a list. All the movies he's ever been in. I'm calling that Google assisted memory. It's really IMDb assisted, but it's the internet assisted memory. Frankly, Google is there. If you type Chris Cooper in Google, that would work just as well, wouldn't it? Because the first link probably be IMDb and you'd click that. In fact, that'd probably work better. Nowadays, I think more and more, we don't rely on brain power. We don't have to think things out or puzzle them out or try to remember. Now, I don't know if this is good or bad. The other day, we were sitting with my son doing homework and trying to remember something, you know, like what is the capital of Venezuela, something like that. Instead of trying to remember or going to the encyclopedia, which we might have done in my day, when we were young, we would walk 4 miles to the library to look that up. That's what's really changed over the last 20 years. Would you even... If you didn't know something, you didn't have a reference work at home, and so you didn't have an almanac, or it was something that wouldn't be in the encyclopedia or the almanac, the library is your only way of finding that out. How many times would you just say, I don't know, and forget about it? You're not going to go to the library to figure that stuff out. You just say, I don't know. Don't ask me. What is it? I don't know. A lunar eclipse, new moon, what? Somebody in the chat room says, you just changed the subject. Look at that painting over there. Isn't that neat? Let's go ride bikes. But see, the internet really changes that. Information is at our fingertips. Bill Gates always used to say that. And I don't know. At the time, it sounded like an ad slogan, but now I think he was right. He kind of knew. 10 years ago, he was saying, it's all about information at your fingertips. It's all about, you know. And they would show, Microsoft used to do this at Bill Gates' keynotes. He'd make these incredible movies. I still have one somewhere. About the modern home, you know, someday in the year 2005, there will be screens all over the home. And, you know, they've got Junior sitting on the couch doing his homework, creating a PowerPoint presentation that's in 3 dimensions floating in the air. And Mom is, you know, over in the kitchen, you know, doing the stock market. And that was the future. And I kind of thought, yeah, right. Flying cars. We'll have those too, right. Uh-huh. But you know what? We do. Information is at your fingertips. There's very little. If you're good at using Google, and I would say that's probably the number one skill we should be teaching kids right now. If you're good at using Google, boom, you could find anything in seconds. Isn't that great? Or is it? Or do we no longer think? Are our brains going to atrophy because we don't have to try to remember what movies Chris Cooper was in or try to figure out what's the difference between a lunar eclipse and a new moon? Just so you know. Tonight when you're watching and your daughter says, what's that? What is the difference between this and a new moon? Well, I'll tell you, it looks different. It's going to look blood red because of the sun's light coming through the atmosphere, kind of bending around the earth. a lunar eclipse of the kind we're going to see tonight is really the Earth's shadow being cast across the moon. The Earth is directly in between the sun and the moon, and you can see the shadow go across. It's actually very cool if you've never seen. I'm sure you've seen one, but it's very cool. Great one to drag the kids out to the yard for. And you can ask them, here's a cheat. You want to see how their brains work. When they're out in the yard and they can't go to Google, say, why is it that a lunar eclipse can only occur in the full moon? It has to be a full moon. Why is that? I think it's good for us to have these little puzzles and work our brains. I mean, all the evidence shows that. The more you work your brain, the better. It's like any other muscle. My brain is mostly muscle. I'm kind of a musclehead. The more you work it, the stronger it'll be. It's a great way to fight Alzheimer's. It's a great way to keep yourself working. You want to join the conversation in the chat room? That's always fun. We've got Dan and Mike and Dustin and Illuminati monitoring things. Make sure it's safe for the kids, and it is. It's wonderful. You can go in there by going to irc.dslextreme.com. They host the chat room, irc.dslextreme.com. The chat room channel is #TechGuy. The number sign, T-E-C-H-G-U-Y. The phone number is 8888-ASK-LEO. The website is techguylabs.com. That's where the show notes will be, the links and so forth. And I'll put a link in there to the Wikipedia article on a lunar eclipse. Talk about lazy. You don't even have to go to Google. You just go to techguylabs.com and click the link, and they have a very good explanation of what the difference is between a lunar eclipse and a new moon. And if I had been there at that coffee cart, I would have known. I should have known. Next time, I'll be ready. I'll be prepared. I'll say, well, here, let me show you. This coffee cup is the sun. This salt shaker is the Earth, and I am the moon. Actually, I'm not. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Coming up, Steve Gibson to talk about protecting yourself on open access points and your calls. You stay right here. Leo Laporte, the tech guy from the beautiful Tech Guy Labs in the northernmost part of Silicon Valley. 8888 Ask Leo is the phone number, 888-827-5536. Website is techguylabs.com, and we'll put links up there whenever we have something that we don't want you to write down because you're driving, but we want you to have access to. And I'm using the royal we. Tim in Upland, California, you're first. Welcome, Leo Laporte here. Hey, Tim.
Leo, I got a question about using a Mac Mini as a web server, or not as a web server, as a video server. I want to be able to back up all my DVDs to the Mac Mini and then just be able to scroll through those and watch them at will.
And how do you propose to watch them, on a computer or on a television?
Television.
Are you going to hook the TV up directly to the Mini?
Actually, I have an AV receiver, a Yamaha RX V2700.
And does the Mini, the Mini has a DVI connector out, so does the receiver have DVI or HDMI in?
It has HDMI in, and it also has a RJ45, so it'll hook up to the
I wouldn't do it over the network. Well, you could do it over the network, but that's taxing the network, especially if it's high-quality video. If the Mini is physically next to the receiver, then the best way to do it would be with the DVI or HDMI connector. Now, what you'd have to do is you'd have to buy, and they make a DVI to HDMI adapter. HDMI, which is the new kind of interface for digital video, is electrically the same as DVI, but HDMI carries audio, as DVI does not. So you'd have a secondary connector into that cable that would have the audio out of the Mac Mini. You probably have to buy another cable that splits a mini jack out into left and right, red and white. Those little red and white RCA connectors. But anyway, that's just a cabling issue. Next issue is, well, how do I play it? Now, the nice thing about the Mini is, and all Macs now have this software, this front row software built in. And if you can see the video in iTunes, and that's a big if, then you can use the front row, which looks like Windows Media Center. It's a Media Center interface. And it even has a remote control to play back your videos.
What I'm looking for more than that is to be able to actually not just play the DVD, but to back it up and then play it off the hard drive. Right.
No problem. No problem. It'll do that. So that's not a big deal. In fact, that's a different. You know, there's four entries in front row. There's movies. There's DVDs. There's music and there's pictures. So you would the DVD would if you make a copy. Now there I'll talk about how you do that because of course these are copy protected. But if you make a copy of the DVD on the hard drive, it will be seen as a DVD and can be played as long as it can be played by Apple's DVD. Are you familiar with Mac? Hello? Did I lose you? Are you familiar with how the Mac works, Tim? What happened? Oh, I lost him. That's the key. I mean, I wouldn't recommend using a Mac if you just want to hook it onto the network. Then you could just use any network attached storage. Any hard drive that has a network interface card will work fine, and it's cheaper and it's simpler because you're not using the operating system. You just really want to use this as storage that you pull off. But then you're going to need. Then you can't just use your AV receiver. You're going to need a computer or something on the other end. That's why I think the Mini's a good choice, connected directly to the AV receiver. But you're going to then use Apple's interface to your videos. If you can get it in iTunes, and a lot of video you can get in iTunes. Of course, with iTunes, you can also buy movies and you can buy television shows. And then they'll play back in iTunes. That'll work with Front Row. If QuickTime will play it, it generally will work with iTunes. There are a couple of plugins you should get. One is called Perian, P-E-R-I-A-N. It's free. It enhances QuickTime so it can play more kinds of movies, including DivX and so forth. So that's probably a worthwhile thing to do. And then the secondary issue is, well, how do I get DVDs on the hard drive? And that's the same, you know, that's a problem for everybody because DVDs are copy protected. So you need software that will do that. If you want the full DVD, including all the extras and the menus and everything, then a program called DVD Backup will work. It removes the copy protection, but it copies the files, you know, the VOB files, the TS, all the video._TS, all the menu structure, all of that into a folder, which Apple's DVD player will then play handily. So Front Row will work with it. You could also use a program like Handbrake that will then rip the DVD and convert it into an MPEG-4 format that iTunes can also play. You'll have to do some fiddling with the settings to make it iTunes compatible. If you can play it in iTunes, you can play it on Front Row. So I think if you want to, really what you're trying to do is make a media center, right? So if you really want to make a media center, you need a computer. If all you want to do is, you know, stream movies from over the network, but then your AV player is not going to do that. Your AV player, maybe your AV receiver is smart about seeing stuff streamed over the network, but in most cases, you need a computer at the other end that can say, okay, I'm going to fetch this data from the network. This data I happen to know is video, and I can play it back. I think you need a computer, and I think the Mini is a good choice. About $700, and that you don't need to get a fancy Mini. You might want to add an external hard drive to it, because A, the hard drive in the Mini is relatively small, and B, it's a little slow. An external hard drive will double that capacity, and the Mini will treat it just like it's another hard drive, you know, FireWire or USB. I think that's actually a good solution, but it's going to take a little fiddling around to do it. Hey, Steve Gibson's coming up. He is a security expert. We've had him on the show many times before. He's from GRC.com. That's where Shields Up and his other free security programs are. He does a security podcast with me on This Week in Tech. And he wants to talk a little bit about a very important subject. If you've ever used your Wi-Fi laptop at a Starbucks or any internet hotspot, if you use it at a hotel, you're not secure. He's going to tell you how to secure your internet connection on an open access point. You stay right here. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
You're up.
Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, coming to you from the fantastic, spacious, and ever geeky Tech Guy Labs in the northernmost part of Silicon Valley. I mean real north. Practically the North Pole. It's time to say hello to my good friend, Mr. Freefile. Mike Lazzara worked for many years with me on Call for Help, the TV show we did in Toronto. He is, in fact, really his fort, his métier, his thing was free files. He's always been great at finding them. And I thought it'd be fun. I know everybody likes free stuff. If he could come, kind of fun if he could come on and talk about it every. And someday you're going to have MrFreeFile.com.
Yeah, it's slowly coming together. I have a bunch of projects underway, a couple of vidcasts, a couple work things. So it's on its way. Like in the next probably few weeks, you're going to start seeing stuff up there. Hopefully it'll be big and glorious and full of lots of free files.
Good. Well, and I hope some of these free files will be there as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So let's start. Actually, this one's kind of interesting. Corel, the folks who bought WordPerfect Office and have been putting it out ever since, a Canadian company, I might add. I don't know if there's any favoritism going on here, but
absolutely none.
They've decided to offer an online version of their flagship WordPerfect.
Absolutely, and it's called WordPerfect Lightning. And you actually sent this to me, Leo. And it's an absolutely fantastic free file. The way I would categorize it, it's kind of like an online, offline notebook, but you can do a lot more than just make notes and, you know, add information in.
People who have used WordPerfect, will they feel comfortable with it? I mean, does it look a lot like WordPerfect? I haven't tried it yet.
You know what? It looks just like, you know, I mean, it looks like a basic word processor, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. It integrates closely with WordPerfect, but you don't need WordPerfect to use this. The best way I can describe it is, in fact, it's a way of quickly making notes and adding content to your, you know, from web pages, from documents, from all kinds of sources, and keeping it in one central location. For an example, if you went to a website, and let's say there was, you know, a great quote on your website, Leo, you highlight it and you just copy and you paste it directly into the notebook. Mm. Say, for instance, maybe there was a picture or maybe there was a multimedia content. Again, you just copy and paste it, and it automatically keeps all the formatting, all the information right there for you, and dumps it into this notebook. So you can keep very kind of detailed information regarding, you know, for instance, maybe free files even.
We're seeing a lot of online applications. In fact, this isn't even the first online web word processor. In fact, there have been many. Think Free Office was the first I remember. And, of course, Google purchased Writely, and now it's part of the Google suite. How does this compare with Google, the Google word processor, Google Write, I guess they call it?
Well, you know, it's a little less featured. I really like Google Docs, Google's
Google Docs,
Writely, yes. I really like it. But this is kind of more of a desktop application, and
about this has a desktop component, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It actually sits on your desktop and it runs on your desktop, and then you can sync it to an online server. I think they offer 200 megabytes of free storage, and I think you can also upgrade as well later on. It just essentially sits on your desktop. And I like applications that stay on your desktop because they remind you that they're sitting there and you don't forget what they are or move on to the next thing. Because it's so easy, especially with the Web 2.0 world, to find a new application that's a little bit better, and suddenly you've left all your data in your old documents.
I can't find my to-do list. I know it's somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's what I like about desktop-based applications, because you always remember they're there and you always see it. So you're like, oh, I should make a note of that. Let me put it in there quickly.
WordPerfect Lightning. It's Corel, Corel.com.
Yep.
And go ahead. I interrupted you. You said it was very simple.
That's okay. It's very simple and easy to use. You know, all the icons are fairly self-explanatory. You know, you'll see a little link icon if you want to link to a particular web page. You know, it's very easy to use, very obvious, and it doesn't, you know, it works like a web
fast
application.
Lightning
but
fast. And people are searching for the best way
Thank
to keep
you, music.
It.
I
That's why
really.
Corel.
Thank you, Corel. Started singing. I was playing with a website. I hate these websites that music. This is, by the way, just another one of these. As I said, there's a lot of them. And Adobe, at the same time as this came out, Adobe has announced they're going to do an online version of Photoshop. So I wonder.
Oh, you know, very cool. I didn't know about that.
That's where the future is moving, yeah.
Wow, absolutely.
Now, you have one more free file for us. This is South by Southwest.
Yeah, and this is a really neat one. This is a BitTorrent 3-gigabyte file that allows you to download almost a day and a half's worth of music for free.
From the South by Southwest conference?
Yeah, absolutely. Performers there, you know, they give away songs from what they're going to be doing there, and you know, other work that they've done. It's an absolutely free download.
793 MP3 songs. Is that what it is? Holy
yeah,
cow!
Absolutely. And where else can you get that many songs for free?
It's legal.
It's legal. Absolutely nowhere. So it's fun. It's easy. You download it, and I was playing at work the other day, and I was just, you know, listening to all these kinds of new artists. None of them I had heard about before, but a couple of them I might be looking up in the future because they're very nicely done.
See, that's why it works.
Absolutely.
Because you get turned on to new stuff, and then maybe they'll even sell some music.
Absolutely.
Yeah. South by Southwest is coming up in Austin March 9th through the 18th. I was going to be down there this next coming weekend, and my plans changed because I'm going to the big radio and records conference in Los Angeles. But everybody, it's both a music festival and an interactive festival. Everybody who's anybody on the net is going to be there. It's breaking my heart to miss it. Mr. Freefall,
yeah,
you've got to go down there.
I know I should, but unfortunately I have work commitments up here, so I'm stuck in the same boat as you, Leo, but I'm going to be watching all the blogs, and you know, I'm sure there'll be tons of video coming out of the South by Southwest, and it'll make me feel like I'm almost there,
yeah.
Just like you, Leo.
Very cool, yeah.
Yeah.
Mike Lazazara in freezing cold, icy Toronto. He will be joining us every week with his Free Files of the Week. Mr. Free File, thanks for stopping by, Mike.
Thanks for having me, Leo.
I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones. Michael in Los Angeles. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Leo.
Welcome.
I've written a book for the Harry Potter age group, and it hasn't been published yet.
Oh, cool.
And I want to bring... I'm sorry?
That's really... You know, I can't believe when I was a kid, there weren't very many books for that age group. And now
yeah.
It's just fantastic. In fact, some of the best fiction being written is for juveniles.
I started reading the Harry Potter books, and it just inspired me to take a script that I had written and turn it into the book that it is today.
What's it called?
It's called Wish Seekers.
Uh-huh.
And I've got a website, wishseekers.com, and I want to bring people to this website to have them help me in the self-publishing process.
Great.
And I want to know, what's the best way, on a very limited budget, to bring a target audience to my site?
And the basic premise of getting people to come to your site is going to where the natural audience is and talking to them.
Yes.
And that makes sense, right? I mean, that's just obvious. So
yes.
You have a natural audience, which is great, the Harry Potter group. So you go to the message boards, you know, that cater to them, and there are quite a few. You go to the websites that cater to them, and you post postings. You call the Harry Potter... There are several very big Harry Potter podcasts, like the MuggleCast. You call them and say, hey, I'd like to be on the MuggleCast. You know, in other words, you reach out to that audience. One of the things that people learn pretty quickly is that it's easy to make a website. It's easy to write a book. It's easy to publish a book. It's easy to make a song or create your own movie. I mean, the tools really are there. The one thing that the record company, the publishing company, the movie company did that is hard to do is promote it, is market it. Now, I have to say, having written 13 books and done a few other things in mainstream media, ironically, most of the time you're on your own, even if you have a big publisher. You're still the guy who's going out and promote it. Unless you're Danielle Steele, you promote your own books. So I think that you're doing pretty much what you should be doing these days, which is publishing it yourself so you get the bulk of the money and using modern kind of guerrilla marketing tactics to promote it. A website's a great start. You might want to do a podcast. You know, a lot of authors are doing podcast readings of their books, and that seems to do very well. You don't have to do the whole book at a time. You can do a chapter at a time, but believe me, that sells books. In fact, I think even releasing a chapter or segments on the website is good. Are you selling on Amazon?
Well, since I haven't published it yet, see, what I'm actually doing is I'm trying to bring in people who would see the idea and maybe get behind it before the book is actually published, and I'm offering these different packages.
Let me maybe give you a hint in another direction. Have you ever heard of Lulu?
No.
Lulu.com.
Okay.
It's self-publishing, but it's done, I think,
the
right
way. Oh, yes, I have heard of Lulu. Yes, I have.
Yeah, because it's print-on-demand, so there's no upfront cost. Now, normally, with a self-publishing, you have to pay $5,000 or $10,000 to get the first press run. There's no press run.
Oh, it's quite
expensive. Yeah. On Lulu, you upload your book as a PDF, a Word document, any electronic format. All your job at that point is to get orders. They can buy it on Amazon, by the way. Lulu puts it on Amazon. They can buy it on Lulu. Lulu prints it when they buy it. So there's no upfront cost to you, and you get a very large share of the proceeds. I think it's more than 50%. And it's, I think, a much more effective way to self-publish. It makes self-publishing really a reality. They do a very nice job, by the way. So you should look at some of the samples, maybe even order a book or two just to see if they're going to do the job you want.
Right.
But I now I see you want to do do you want to do a full color book and things like that? You want to do a pretty elaborate printing?
Oh yeah, I want it to be equivalent to, you know, the Harry Potter books.
Well, I think you could do that. I would look at Lulu. I think you can do that. And then you don't have to do all this trying to raise money, you know, but really you can just all you got to do is get orders. And I think that's a better place for you to focus your energy. Let's sell some books.
Okay.
Use all that, you know. I mean, it's great. Everybody who's going to contribute is going to buy books, obviously.
Right.
But I don't know. I might be a little reluctant to contribute to somebody who says, yeah, I'm going to publish a book. All you'd have to do is give me some seed capital.
Well, on the website, I'm offering things like, on the very back of the book, I'm offering 150 places to put people's names.
That's a good idea.
And then if your kid's name was, your child's name, was in the very back of the very first Harry Potter book, you know, and if it became popular,
wouldn't that be cool?
Oh, absolutely. So I'm hoping that's what I can do with
the other thing. The other thing to do is, you know, don't eschew mainstream traditional media like radio, TV, magazines, because that's also a very good source of publicity. In fact, you know, I think we've found in the user generated content area that the best publicity comes from mainstream media still, because we haven't made that transition yet. But I would go to where the audience is and let them know you're there. Also get other sites, if you can get those other Harry Potter sites to link to you and vice versa, that'll raise you in Google. So then what you really want is when people do a search for Harry Potter, you show up. Don't try to play tricks on Google. That's always a bad idea because they could delist you for that. Do it the right way by getting people to link to you. Leo Laporte here. I am the tech guy. Steve Gibson coming up.
High-speed internet is not a luxury, it's a necessity. It's the only way you could participate in the internet revolution we talk about all the time on this show, like YouTube, downloading music, you know, watching movies. All of that stuff requires high speed. If you're still on dial-up, I've got a better way. DSL Extreme. Now hold on to your hats, because this price is amazing. $12.95 a month for high-speed internet. And there's nothing additional to pay for. There's no special services you have to get, like from the phone company. There are no setup fees. There's no charge for the modem. It's free. 24-hour-a-day free local tech support. Now, this is $12.95 a month, and it's not for 1 month or 2 months or 3 months. It's for the first year, but you got to be a new customer. There are some geographic restrictions. Well, look, do me a favor. Call 866, the number 2-GET-NET right now. 866-2-GET-NET, or visit them online at dslextreme.com. High speed internet for $12.95 a month. Call 866 the number 2 get net to get DSL Extreme.
You're up.
I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We are talking tech at 8888 Ask Leo. But as usual, every week I like to talk to my friend Steve Gibson from GRC.com. Steve's the creator of a number of really good free security utilities like Shields Up to test your router, and Securable to see what security capabilities your PC has. Shoot the Messenger, Decombobulator, Unplug and Pray. The list goes on and on. Of course, he also is the creator of SpinRite, the ultimate disk recovery and maintenance utility, which, Steve, I'm happy to say I used this week to save my PC. So I
thank
you.
That is so cool, Leo.
Oh, man.
That is really wonderful.
Well, it's that bad feeling that you get. The PC I'm talking about is the one I use to do all my audio recording. I do all the podcasts on it. I do all the editing on it. It's my workhorse machine. And it just wouldn't boot. It said, I don't see any operating system here. Oof. And I thought, what am I going to do? And then I thought, oh, wait a minute. I know exactly what to do. I put in the SpinRite CD because it boots to the CD. And that's so you can still check the disc. The disc was visible. It just wasn't booting.
Yep.
And it fixed it. And it's been booting reliably ever since.
So. Fantastic.
Thank you. So last week, we talked about hard drive reliability. And if you listen to our Security Now podcast for this week, there's a lot more detail on that. I thought that was a great subject. What should we talk about this week?
Well, I wanted to mention something that you and I covered actually quite a while ago on one of our Security Now podcasts, talking about the danger of open wireless access points.
Okay. Those are the things that, they're all open when you go to Starbucks or a hotel or an airport, that you're on an open access point. That's the only way you could get in unless you had a password, right?
Exactly. And what most people don't appreciate is that there is readily available so-called sniffing software that anyone with a laptop in that geographical region could use, basically to capture all of the internet traffic that all the users in that environment are transacting. So, for example, if someone uses their laptop and checks their email, unless they have a secure connection to their email server, their username and password is going out in the clear, and all of their email passing back into their laptop or out is what's called clear text. It's completely capturable and readable by anybody else in that location.
I'm really nervous about the password getting captured, because if somebody snags your email password, they can get your email from now on. They can log onto your server no matter where you are. You don't have to be on that open network anymore. Until you change your email password, they're reading everything on your server.
Well, yes. And what one of the other newer problems is that capturing a username and password also allows people to deposit spam as you on your ISP server.
I never thought of that.
Ooh. Yeah, I hesitate to call it a growth industry, but there's now new motivation.
They make money at it.
Yes, for people capturing individuals' unsuspecting email logon and then using that to broadcast spam all over the internet.
That's a little terrifying. So what do we do about it?
Well, the thing to do is to, if you're using your laptop to connect to your corporation, you ought to ask the people who run your IT system if you're using a secure protocol, a secure technology, to go from wherever you happen to be, whether you're in a hotel or at a Wi-Fi hotspot or whatever. All email servers have the ability to give you a secure connection. And if you're not using that now, you ought to ask your IT people if there's a way you can. Many people are using free email services like Hotmail or Yahoo or Google Mail. And those also have the option, although it's oftentimes not the default, to use a secure connection for logging into their servers. So it's something worth exploring. Certainly with Google, for example, people are used to typing http://, and then, for example, mail.google.com. If you type https, S stands for secure, /mail.google.com, that's a secure logon, and then not only your logon, but then all of your following transactions with Google Mail will be kept secure, even if you're in an open wireless access point.
There's no, we talk all the time about securing your home access point by turning on WPA encryption, but there's no way you can really do that on an open access point. Is there any way you can secure your conversations on an open access point?
Well, there are sort of some sophisticated approaches known as a virtual private network, a VPN, where you could use a VPN essentially to connect to, for example, your corporate network, or in some cases to your home network, and then everything passing through would be encrypted and nobody could see anything you were doing.
So you'd be not just your email, everything would be secure that you do.
Everything would be secure. What I wanted to do was to suggest to people, anyone who wants more about this, in episode 10 of Security Now, you and I spend about half an hour talking about this and go into additional detail. And so people could go to grc.com/securitynow and then scroll back to episode 10. We just have MP3 files, standard audio files that can be downloaded and give people a lot more in-depth coverage of this.
Yep. And I think in that episode I mentioned the service I use, which is about $10 a month. It's called Hotspot VPN, hotspotvpn.com. And that'll totally secure you, everything you're doing while you're online. It's really easy to use, too, Windows or Mac. GRC.com is Steve's site. Of course, the other place you can go to get security now is the TWIT Podcast Network, TWIT.TV. And we have all 81 episodes of Security Now online. You can even listen on, we have a little flash player there. So that's another place.
Oh, that's even easier. I think that's cool.
To download it, just press play. And you said it was episode 10, although we covered VPN in a bunch of episodes, but 10 is the one you want to listen to.
Yep.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Steve. We'll see you next week. GRC.com is Steve's website, and Steve is the security master, but also the author of the great SpinRite Hard Drive Recovery and Maintenance Utility. Take care, Steve.
Thanks, Leo.
I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy, and we talk a lot about this kind of stuff, as I said, on the twit.tv, but also on the show, and I'd love to hear your questions about securing yourself on Wi-Fi or about your cell phone, about your home theater. When we come back in just a little bit, we're going to talk about a MacBook and Vista and accessing American radio stations from France. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You stay right here. Tech Guy Labs in beautiful Northern California, high atop Silicon Valley. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So glad you joined me today. We are going to talk about technology and all kinds of technology on this show. And in fact, I'll talk with you if you call 888-ASK-LEO, 888-ASK-LEO. That's 888-827-5536. And coming up in just a little bit, Paul Thurrott, my Windows guru, with a really cool Windows Vista tip. If you're thinking about moving to Vista, especially for those of us over a certain age, like 40, who need reading glasses, sometimes on a big display, you know, when you've got as we get these larger and larger displays and the icons and the text get smaller and smaller, you need a little help. Paul's got a great tip. I'm disappointed, I have to say, recently. I have recommended in the past Microsoft's antivirus, anti-spyware solution, Windows One Care. I don't recommend it for sophisticated users, for people who really know what they're doing. I like Nod 32 for that. That's kind of my favorite antivirus. And a disclaimer, an advertiser on our Los Angeles station. But Windows One Care is, you know, hey, it's from Microsoft. It's very easy. It's very transparent. It's inexpensive because I think it's, what is it, $50 for up to three different computers. It does a lot of security and so forth. However, bad news, it is a terrible antivirus. Now, we've seen this twice now. Researchers, this one's at avcomparatives.org, av-comparatives.org, an independent antivirus researcher, took a look at all of the antiviruses. And the way they test these is they take viruses, they infect machines, and they use the antiviruses, and they rank them based on how many of the viruses these antiviruses detected. In this case, they infected a machine with almost 500,000. That's how many there are. 500,000 viruses. And in fact, Windows One Care, they tried a bunch of antiviruses, including the free one Avast, one of the free ones Avast, Kaspersky, Nod32, Norton, F-Secure. Windows One Care was the worst. 82% recognition rate. That means it missed 18% of those 500,000 viruses. You do the math. In fact, it was the only product he tested that got under 90%. TrustPort, GData, Avira, F-Secure, and Kaspersky all found 97% of the viruses. Now, and notice, by the way, nobody gets 100%. Really important to know this stuff. You can't, as I've said several times, anti-spyware antivirus programs are your second line of defense. The first line of defense is changing your behavior. It's a little disappointing, though, to see that Windows One Care, which I think I recommended to a lot of novices, and I think a lot of novices choose just because it's the Microsoft product, is so rotten. I mean, look. Okay, you miss 3%. That's pretty much the standard. To miss 18% is frankly, I'm going to have to stop recommending it. Now, many of these have evaluations and so forth. I'm going to send you to av-comparatives.org. There are other companies like the Virus Bulletin that are independent antivirus testers, and I would absolutely... I kind of like Virus Bulletin's methodology in a way better than AV Comparatives, but it's good to get as much information as you can from this. And I guess the takeaway, the bottom line is, wow. OneCare, not so hot. Didn't do a good job. I always love it when we get international calls from Normandy in France. Adrian. Hello, Adrian.
Hi, Leo. Leo, I've got a question that may be of interest to American listeners as well who happen to travel abroad. I've noticed in recent months that it's becoming more and more difficult to pick up live streams, radio streams out of the USA. Now, I gather this is because the service detects that I'm not in the US.
Right, right.
Is there a way of, let's say, spoofing, or well, I don't know what the right term is, but of making it appear that I'm in the US?
Absolutely. I probably shouldn't tell you this.
But well, I was wondering about this.
But I'm going to tell you anyway, because I'm a bad
okay,
boy.
Well,
I noticed this happened with one of our, with the mothership. In fact, all the Clear Channel stations stopped broadcasting internationally on the stream. And I think that there's a couple of reasons why this happens. First of all, advertising in general is national, not international. Even though these companies are international, the advertising is all bought by, at best, national agencies. So the advertisers who buy the internet stream aren't paying for you to listen in France. And
sure.
It costs
money.
I'm sure
that they would be happy to know that their stream is going out wider than what they pay for.
You'd think so. I've run into this with podcasting, too. Podcasting is even more aggressively global. Almost a quarter of my audience on the podcast is international. And the agencies, you know, let's say, like, I'll give you an example, Dell, which buys advertising on my podcasts. The U.S. Now, Dell's global. You could probably buy a Dell in France. You certainly can buy them in many countries around the world.
Yeah. In fact, I have one.
Yeah. There's Dell.fr, probably. There's Dell.ca. So Dell definitely gets benefit from an advertisement heard in France and Canada and Australia and all over the world. However, the agency that buys the ad is a U.S. agency, an ad agency, and they don't care. Their budget, they have a certain budget, and they don't care. They don't get any brownie points for selling computers in France. The French agency would. So understand that the problem with streaming is that every single person who listens costs you money. Unlike, you know, internet broadcasting, whether it's a podcast or a live stream, is the exact opposite of radio. Radio, I put up a transmitter and a tower, and if one person listens or a million people listen, the bill is exactly the same. So I want a million people. But think about magazines, for instance. Now, every single person who reads a magazine costs the publisher money because they've got to print a copy, and it's expensive. So magazines frequently control their circulation. Streaming, internet, and podcasts, same thing. Every single person who listens to this stream, Adrian, is in effect downloading the file. It takes up, you know, it takes up a lot of bandwidth. It is costly. It's not free.
No.
And so they've
that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, they're trying to. It's an economy to say, okay, well, we're just going to try to limit it to the people who actually are of benefit to us. We want the ears of people who can buy the products or who will get advertising benefit from. We don't want these other people's ears. So that's why they do it. Now, of course, you can fool it. You could fool it the same way that Chinese dissidents fool the Chinese government and are able to look at, you know, Falun Gong websites using proxy servers. And there are a number of anonymous proxy servers you can use that will look like you're coming from the internet. I'll tell you what, if you go to publicproxyservers.com, they have a list of public proxy servers that are free, and you can pick one that's in the U.S. If you use the proxy server, you will appear to be coming in from the U.S., and you'll be able to listen to any stream or go to any site if you want to. For instance, when you use Google, Google senses that you're in France and will give you google.fr instead of google.com.
Sure.
This would fool Google. Not that Google cares. In fact, Google will let you choose google.com if you want. So there are the proxy server. That's the whole idea. It's a intermediate server that you go through. It becomes your address in the outside world, and that's all they're looking at. They look at the IP address, and they say, well, that IP address belongs to a French internet service provider. We're not going to let you on.
Okay. Well, that was what I was wondering. In fact, I was thinking about something like the Onion Router or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
But now, also, do you know if there would be something like that in what's my native South Africa as well?
Absolutely. It works the same around the
world. South Africa that I'd like to listen to, sure. And I can't get to it for the same reason.
Yeah, it works around the world. So now, I don't recommend the Onion Router because the Onion Router is designed for privacy and so sends you through many routers. That's going to slow the stream down to be unusable. What you want to use is a single router that is located in the country that you want to listen in.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying? So that way, you're only one hop.
Yes.
One hop isn't going to slow it down enough so that you won't be able to listen to the stream. That's why public proxy.
Well, that was what I was wondering about, the Onion Router. Essentially, if there was a way of specifying the final, because it will have to be the final one that you pass through, needs to be in the
right.
That you're targeting. So, that's very useful.
Yeah, it's not the right tool.
Will this also work for Napster, for instance?
Yes, it'll work for anything, because once again, if you choose a proxy server in the U.S., your traffic goes to that proxy server first and then emerges from that proxy server into the U.S., and it looks as if your IP address is that proxy server's IP address. So it will work for anything that checks IP addresses.
Okay, excellent.
It doesn't anonymize you because there's only one hop. If anonymity is what you're looking for, then you want to use something like the Tor routers.
Yeah, no, that's not. It's essentially just to be able to get into, make it appear that I'm somewhere else.
And that's why, by the way, companies like Napster and iTunes don't look at your IP address. They look at your credit card. They say, all right, you want to buy songs? Because you can't buy songs in a lot of countries on these places. I know France, for instance, wants to shut down iTunes. So what if they do? Well, if you had a U.S. credit card, you could do it. But that's what they look at. So, well, what's your address? In fact, I know some Canadians that's how they do it. They get a U.S. credit card or they get an American friend to buy it for them or they use their credit card. Look, I don't want, and again, this is maybe a little touchy politically. I understand why these stations and these other companies don't, they want to restrict it. On the other hand, as a host, you want the global audience, don't you? One of the things that gives me great pride is that the number of calls we get. We got a call last week from Beijing. We got a call, just got a call from France. I mean, that's, to me, as a host, that's gravy. That's gold. That's wonderful. But remember, to the station that stream you're listening to the stream of, you're costing them money. And you're not giving them any revenue. So I understand why they do that. And frankly, I take some credit for that because I know that this show in particular, is heavily listened to on the internet. And as a result, I think we probably cost Clear Channel quite a bit of money. Sorry. Whoops. What can I do? It's just me, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
All you have to say for yourself is oops.
Whoops.
I'm a bad boy.
I'm sorry.
My bad. My bad.
Naomi, well know that I am a very happy and proud
I love
DSL Extreme
say that.
Customer.
My bad.
DSL Extreme is the internet service provider that offers amazing service for the lowest price anywhere.
Hey, you're up.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy on K. I'm sorry, I almost said the wrong thing. I'm on every station all over the country, WRK. Let me give you the phone number, 8888. Ask Leo. My producer, Rebecca Baker, sent me a great link from the Center for Biological Diversity. How would you like a wild animal ringtone? They're free. You could have a blue-throated macaw, a beluga whale, the boreal owl, a mountain, yellow-legged frog, a Yosemite toad, 40 different ringtones. You download them right to your phone. I love this. idea. Let me give you the URL. It's rareearthtones, all one word, .org. rareearthtones.org. Now, I'd play them for you, but you have to actually deliver them to your phone. So I can't. But, if you go to the site, get them on your phone. I think that's a great idea. Instead of, I have to say, I am so sick of, hearing Madonna or a rap song on the ringer. Don't you, I mean, just get sick of that, don't you? So I think, I actually went to a more traditional, plain old ringer. Here's a cascade. Let's see. What do we want? Here's a frog. Let's see what that sounds like. See that? Not a good ringtone. You think something's in your pocket. Let's see. Those are frogs, toads. How about an orca? That'd be kind of cool. Oh, yeah. You'd want to pick up the phone there. Now, what I wouldn't recommend doing is, how you can assign special ringtones to people. That would be mean to, say, assign the orca to your wife or something. Don't do that. This is a wolf. Now, see, that's a good ringtone. Oh, I like that. It's chilling. It's my personal campaign to get music off the ringtones and something more interesting. RareEarthTones.org. Let's go to line one. That's Frank and Toby Hanna,
PA. Hi,
hey, Frank, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I wanted to ask you this question for about a week and a half, but I listen to you when I'm on my recumbent bike in the gym, and it's tough getting the iPod to talk back to me.
Well, see, that's, sometimes people say, why do you do a podcast? Nobody's going to listen to the radio show. This is why. Mm-hmm. If you want to call in, you got to listen.
I have this question about a MacBook Pro and Vista.
Okay.
I put Vista on my daughter's MacBook Pro a couple weeks ago.
Using Parallels or Boot Camp?
Using Boot Camp.
Okay.
And the installation went fine. As a matter of fact, I was wirelessly connected when I was doing the installation, and it seemed to download all the files that it needed that were necessary as the program installed.
Yeah.
And then when I attempted to use Vista, booting up through Boot Camp, wireless just won't work.
Oh, dear.
I can plug an RJ45 cable in and get on the internet just fine.
So everything else is working. It's just the Wi-Fi.
Wi-Fi will not work. I went to Device Manager, checked that out. And
Understand that when you use Boot Camp, what happens, and you know this, is as part of the process, first, of course, it partitions the drive, makes room for Vista. But then the part of the process is it gives you drivers. It makes you burn a DVD or CD with the drivers. And those are from Apple, drivers for the Apple hardware that Vista will need. I think at least the last time I checked, Apple didn't actually give you Vista drivers. They gave you XP drivers, and that may be part of the problem. You got the latest version of Boot Camp?
I did.
I would say that you're going to need to manually install the drivers.
Well, I went out and I looked at what the name of the drivers were in XP, because I do also have Parallels on the machine, and that works fine.
Yeah, because Parallels simulates. It gives a generic interface to the Wi-Fi. You need an Atheros 5600 driver.
Atheros 5600.
Atheros, A-T-H-E-R-O-S is the chipset.
I'm almost positive I downloaded that and installed it in Vista.
Okay. I'm going to put a thread on this subject in the show notes from Insanely Mac, and because it's kind of complicated. You essentially have to install the right drivers. You can't use the XP drivers that are provided. The MacBook Pro, you said Mac Pro or MacBook Pro?
MacBook Pro.
Yeah, the MacBook Pro has the Atheros chipset, and I think you need to have just the right chipset. You go to Update Driver in the Hardware Manager, Browse Manually. You'll need, instead of saying, I've got a disk, you say, let me pick from a list. You'll see a bunch of drivers, because Vista has the driver. You want the 5006 driver. It's an older driver, Microsoft. I'm reading this from the thread.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. So, I'll, again, you update the driver in Vista, In other words, you're going to use Vista's own driver.
Right.
And pick from the list. Look for the Microsoft drivers, the 5006 driver. Try that.
Got you.
Okay.
Thank
and I will
so
put a link
much.
To this discussion in the show notes so that you can, you know, follow along. That's just a question of Apple updating the drivers. They ought to do that soon for boot camp. I like Parallels, frankly. That's how I use Vista. And when I'm using it right now, it's great. Speaking of Vista, Paul Thurrott, our Vista expert, coming up with a great Vista tip. We're going to start doing some Vista tips. I think enough people are starting to use Vista. I'm liking it. Don't recommend it as an upgrade if you're using XP. No, that's a problem. But if you're buying a new computer, you'll get it with Vista. Paul's got a great tip to help us with older eyes coming up. Leo Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy here from the beautiful Tech Guy Labs, the northernmost tip of Silicon Valley. Don't mock me, Paul Thurrott. Paul Thurrott is here.
I'm trying not to laugh.
From the Paul Thurrott Labs in beautiful Dedham, Massachusetts. Paul's my Windows guru. You hear him every week on the Twit Network with Windows Weekly, and you can read his work at the winsupersite.com. It's supersite for Windows at winsupersite.com. Great site. And I thought we'd do, you know, we talk, of course, about news and what's going on with Windows and so forth on the show. But I thought we'd also get some Vista tips. Vista's new. People are trying. They're having fun with it. They're playing with it. But, you know, as a new operating system, you don't know all the secrets, the ins and outs. You wrote the book, Vista Secrets. You ought to know a few. Let's talk about this time. You want to talk about this desktop icons?
Yeah. Now, this one's neat because I didn't know about this.
I'm going to follow along. So go ahead.
Right. So in Windows, in any version of Windows, as you know, you can right-click on the desktop and get various properties. You can turn the icons off. You can make different changes. In Windows Vista, they finally added the ability to change the size of the icons on the desktop.
Hallelujah!
So, right. Now, this is not necessarily a big secret, but in Windows Vista, there are you can have large icons, medium icons, and then classic icons, which is unique to the desktop, but that makes the icons look like they did in Windows XP.
Oh, just what I
Well, what I didn't know was if you have a mouse, this won't really work on a laptop with a slider per se, but if you have a mouse, you can hold down the, you can click, what you do is you click an area of the desktop.
Okay.
You hold down the control key. And then you use the scroll window, the scroll button on your mouse, and it will dynamically change the icons to any size.
Oh, that's
including
sick. Look at that.
Super, super duper duper big, you know? So you can make these icons whatever size you want, and that is really cool.
That's so slick. Well, super duper duper big would be great for kids. If you just put four programs that they use on their login, they would run those programs. I think that's
or
really
if you're,
cool.
If you're blind like I am and you have a huge screen and it's super high res and those icons look really teeny by default, you can bump them up to whatever you want.
Yeah, in fact, I also changed the text size. You told me a tip earlier on that I found very useful, changing the DPI. Your desktop. Now, you could do that in XP, but it works better in Vista.
It's still not perfect in Vista, but it does work better. And I think that this combined with that will make high-res displays much more viable for more people.
Where do you, just for people's reference, where do you change the DPI?
So that one, you right-click on the desktop and you choose Personalize. And then up in the upper left corner of that window that appears, you'll see an option that says Adjust Font Size and then DPI in parentheses.
Excellent.
And you can click on that.
You do have to restart, don't you, to get that size?
You do have to restart, yep.
Paul Thurrott is the author with Brian Livingston of Windows Vista Secrets. If you're going to buy one Windows Vista book, that's the one to buy. That's the one I bought. And it's for more advanced users. It's got, things like this, the inside secrets to how Vista works. And a lot of good information on security and so forth. I recommend it highly. Windows Vista Secrets. Who's the publisher on that, Paul?
Wiley.
I should know.
I'm so glad I was able to answer that so quickly. I was waiting for that inevitable pause. I don't know who the publisher
is. No, you do know
it's
that.
It's one of those companies that publishes books.
Paul Thurrott, thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week. Take care. David in Harrisburg. Welcome. Leo Laporte, the tech guy here.
Hi, Leo. How are you? Pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, David.
Been a fan for a long time, going back to Tech TV.
Awesome. Well, I'm so glad you called. I really appreciate it.
Hey, I have a question. I'm a Mac user, and I'm a Mac fanatic, as a lot of my friends say. My friends who aren't Mac users.
Yeah, that's generally the people who say that. You zealot.
I tell them it's a religion. You know, it's not just a computer.
Yeah.
I'm one of the few of us, though, who's not really excited about the iPhone. I was excited about it first, but there are a lot of things that I don't like about it. One, there's the fact that there's such a low storage capacity.
Right. Although I have to tell you, we don't really know what the iPhone's really going to look like until it comes out in June. There are all sorts of rumors flying, for instance, that they're going to change the processor. You know, Steve Jobs never said what processor was going to be in there. Everybody's agreed it's an ARM, but there's some rumors going that it may not be a strong ARM and maybe something else. So, you know, yeah, there's specs out there. Apple hasn't said all that much. I think I'm going to reserve judgment anyway until it comes out. I mean, it's hard to talk about a product that isn't even that you can't even hold.
Right. However, I am.
You're not going to wait, though, are you? You're going to buy a phone today.
Well, not today. Probably before June, though.
Yeah.
I'm in need of a smartphone. I'm also a T-Mobile customer and don't want to have to leave them. But okay.
Which you kind of would have to do with the iPhone, although because it's a GSM phone, if you can unlock it, you could use it with T-Mobile.
Right. What I'm looking for is a smartphone that can easily be synced with the Mac, and I don't need it to sync on all capabilities. I basically just want something for email and for calendar. I don't need an MP3 player. I don't need a camera. I don't need texting capabilities.
I think a BlackBerry is then the right choice for you. In fact, a BlackBerry RIM now they have licensed Pocket Mac, which was the only way you could sync a BlackBerry with the Mac. And they now offer it for free. So when you get a BlackBerry, you go online to RIM's website, you download Pocket Mac for BlackBerry. It does an excellent job of synchronizing calendar, address book, email if you choose, notepad, tasks, everything. And I have always liked the BlackBerry as an email. I mean, I think it's the best email phone. If you just told me, I don't care about MP3, I don't care about camera, that's a BlackBerry right there. Because it doesn't, you know, you don't have those choices in most of the models. I like the 8700. I don't know if I don't know which models the T-Mobile folks are offering. I have singular.
I really like the look of the dash and the feel of the dash.
Yeah.
But there's no way that Windows Mobile will
not
sync
so.
At all with that.
Not so. I sync the dash. I have a dash as well, and it syncs fine to the Mac. But you have to buy Missing Sync. You have to buy an additional application.
What would that application be?
It's called Missing Sync. It is an excellent, I highly recommend it. It's from Markspace, markspace.com. It's their Windows Mobile 5 synchronization tool. Not expensive. I don't remember exactly what, but $30 or $40. And does an excellent job of syncing up to the T-Mobile Dash or any Windows Mobile 5 phone. So I've used it to sync to a number of Windows Mobile 5 phones. It does a great job. You know, syncing is always problematic. You know, you get duplicates and, you know, there are always issues, but I found it to do a very good job. My one little complaint, and I found this on a number of phones, not just with Missing Sync, for some reason, my speed dials get erased every time. And I think that's because it's rewriting the contact list every time. Minor annoyance, but it is something to be aware of. In fact, I don't think there are many smartphones now that you can't sync with Mac, because of these third-party applications. It's free with BlackBerry. It is $40 if you want to buy it for any Mobile 5 device. Many Nokia phones, which have some smartphone capabilities, will also sync with the Mac using Apple's own iSync. I actually got a Nokia N93, a very late model, recent Nokia phone, and iSync didn't know about it, but that turned out not to be a problem. I found a guy in Germany who's written a fairly inexpensive plugin for iSync, and that does it. So I have yet to find, you know, used to be, it was a big problem. You couldn't sync phones with the Mac, but I've yet now to find a phone. It's you know, I would say the only one that T-Mobile sells that you can't sync is the Sidekick, but that's because the Sidekick's kind of weird in that regard. It syncs to a website, and you can export, but you can't synchronize. I like the Dash. Good form factor, small. I'm not a Windows Mobile 5 fan, though. I have to say that I am not a Windows Mobile 5 fan. If you don't care about the camera, if you don't care about MP3 playing, I think a BlackBerry is a great choice. Max is in Laguna Woods, California. Max, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Hello, Max.
Hello, Leo. I want to thank you very much. You told me to update my Microsoft, the upgrades.
Yep.
And when I did that, I lost my Microsoft Outlook.
You're very welcome. I'm glad to do it anytime. You're going to blame me? You're going to blame me for that?
Not at all, because I then called Make It Work.
Oh, good. All right.
And a very nice girl said, go to add or delete software. Go down there and look for Microsoft Express. And I deleted that, and it worked perfectly.
Interesting.
What a nice organization.
And they didn't even have to come out. They just did it for you on the phone.
They didn't come out. They didn't charge.
Well, that is nice. That's very nice. That's a heck of a recommendation for them.
That's right.
They're going to put me out of business, Max. That's great.
All right. I have a question. I want to change my number pad so the 123 is where 789 is.
On your computer?
Yes.
So that 123, I'm looking at my number pad, is where, so you want to reverse it. So it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 in numeric order from top to bottom.
Exactly. Like a telephone. Because
yeah.
I get, you know, I'm on the phone and somebody gives me a number and you're thinking telephone.
Right. Yeah, you could do that. I mean, what you would need is a custom keyboard definition. And then, which you can, I'm sure, find somewhere. I'll have to look. I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm sure you can find that somewhere. And then what you'll do is you'll take your keyboard, you'll pop the caps off the top of the keys, and you'll rearrange it. You know.
Oh, I don't care about what the numbers are on the key.
Okay, then you can leave them. The key is, though, that is you've got to get a custom keyboard definition. I don't know if you know this, but the keyboard definition, what each key maps to, is completely done by software. All the keyboard sends is a scan code. And so that's why you can download, for instance, the Dvorak keyboard or other non-QWERTY keyboards definitions. Somebody has, I would think, has written one that reverses these number pads, but I don't know off the top of my head. So I'm going to tell you.
And I could Google keyboard definitions.
Yeah, that's what I would do. Your Windows XP?
Yes.
Yeah, so I would say Windows XP, keyboard definition, and then you're going to have to find some combination of numpad, reverse, remap. It might take a couple of trial searches to find exactly what you're looking for. But I bet you, and I'll do it too, and if I find it, I'll put it in the show notes. But I bet you somebody's written such a thing. It's not even.
Thank you very much.
Not even.
I love the show.
You're welcome. I thank you so much for listening. It's not even that hard to do, frankly. I mean, you know, if you feel a little ambitious, a little geeky, you probably could create your own keyboard definition. Put keys where you want them to be. I wonder how hard that is. I've never actually looked at that. I am sure I'm going to, I'll tell you what, I will do some Googling and find it. When I have something like that, a question that I don't know the exact answer to, just the outlines of, that's when I rely on you. You can go to the chat room, irc.dslextreme.com. You can call me 888-ASK-LEO. That's 888-827-5536. Or you could send me an email, leo@techguylabs.com. And then when I get that answer, whether through your help or my own research, I put it in the show notes at techguylabs.com. Or Shuby, my assistant, will put it in the show notes. And that's why we have the show notes. Because frankly, a lot of times it takes a little while to get all the answers together. And the show notes are updated often later in the week. techguylabs.com. This is show 331. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte here from the beautiful Tech Guy Labs, talking about high tech, as I do every weekend at this time on this bat station. So glad you're here. 888-ASK-LEO, that's my phone number. If you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, I'd love to hear from you about anything with a chip in it. Home theater, cell phones, MP3 players, whatever it is. You ever send a text message to the wrong person? It's easy to do, you know, because you send these phone text messages by phone number, and just as you might misdial a phone number, you might send text messages to the wrong person. I've done it and had some very bizarre, weird conversations with people who I thought, you know, I knew who they were talking to. It was some stranger, and they thought, who is this, and why are they saying these things? It can really go awry. Did in Murray, Kentucky, a middle school teacher sent a text message to a person she thought was her pot dealer, trying to make a score. Turns out it wasn't her pot dealer. It was a Kentucky state trooper. Whoops. He was at dinner, Trevor Pervine, with his wife and parents celebrating a birthday. His phone started buzzing with messages about a pot deal. Yo, man. Oh, wow. Got a score. I'm sure it wasn't quite like that. It's only a text message. But at first he said he thought it was his buddies playing around with him. Eventually realized, no, this is for real. Set up a meeting and arrested a 34-year-old junior high school teacher. She's charged with conspiracy to traffic in controlled substances, possession of marijuana, possession of drug paraphernalia, and terminal stupidity. The Kentucky State Police spokesman gave us the moral to this story. This is a quote. She learned her lesson. Program your dealers into your phone. I don't know. Is that the best? I don't know if that's the best advice. Text messaging is not secure, I don't think. Dominic in Anaheim, California. Or is it Dominique?
Dominic.
Dominic, how are you?
Good, Leo. Hey, love your show.
Thank you.
Hey, I've got a question on antivirus or Windows Firewall.
Okay.
I ran Knob 32, and I did the trial period for 30 days. It worked great. But when it came time to pay, I decided I wanted to go look for, see if I could find a free one that would work just as well.
Okay.
I looked on your website, and I found the one that was the AVG.
Yeah, I recommend three different ones. There's Antivir, which is from free-av.com. There's AVG, free.grisoft, G-R-I-S-O-F-T.com, and Avast from avast.com.
Yeah. Well, I installed the AVG, and what it did was it turned on my firewall.
Interesting.
Okay, yeah, I turned on my firewall, and
that's a good thing to do. It's an odd thing for an antivirus to do, but it's the right thing to do, I think.
Well, it what happened was it's blocking me from getting on to a public city network that I use.
Oh, that's interesting.
Okay, so Earthlink Wi-Fi, I can't get on. I can't log on anymore because of the firewall. But what's interesting is that it says that it's, when I go into the firewall settings under Windows Security Center, it says Norton Internet Worm Protection is currently on. Well, I don't have Norton Internet Worm Protection on my computer.
Did you ever run Norton?
I did, and I used the Norton uninstaller to uninstall before I installed Nod 32, so that was over a month ago.
When you say Norton uninstaller, you mean the one that was on the disk?
I went to their website and downloaded the Norton uninstall program.
Yeah, because Symantec, it's so hard to uninstall Norton. Actually, McAfee's the same. It's not uncommon with antiviruses. They don't want a bad guy to uninstall them, so they make it hard. And it's so difficult to uninstall Norton that Symantec, the parent company, actually offers a heavy-duty remover to get rid of all traces. Apparently, even that didn't work.
Yeah, and it didn't work. It not only didn't work, but it won't turn off. And if I go into the managed security settings for Windows Firewall, it shows that the Windows Firewall is off, but it's showing as on because the Norton Internet Worm Protection is on.
See, this is why I do not recommend Norton. You just in a nutshell encapsulated why I tell people do not buy Norton. I hear more trouble with this program than any other program ever anywhere in the history of the world.
Well, when I installed Nod 32, it worked fine. The firewall was off. It didn't show me any messages, and it worked fine, and I could access that public Wi-Fi network fine. And then as soon as I uninstalled Nod 32 and installed AVG, it turned it on, and now I can't get rid of this. And I went to my registry. I deleted any Symantec registry keys that I've had left, and it's still showing, and I do not know how to get rid of this thing.
In the words of the King of Siam, it is a puzzlement. I'm not really sure what to tell you. I mean, you've done the things that I would tell you to do, which is to get the Symantec remover and remove all traces of Norton. At this point, I would uninstall everything. I mean, really, uninstall everything. Nod 32, you probably uninstalled that. It is true that multiple antiviruses can war with each other. It is also true antiviruses tend not to fully uninstall. I would try to get rid of AVG. I do want to say that while I tell people about free antiviruses because it's better to have a free one than nothing at all, in general, these are not as good and certainly not supported as a commercial one. And I think paying $30 or $40 a year for a commercial antivirus is probably a sensible precaution. But a lot of people say, well, I'm not going to pay for it, period. And if you're not going to pay for it, then use a free one. Better that than nothing. I think AVG is very good. I am not sure why AVG turned on Norton. I'm not even sure Norton's on, to be honest with you. It could very well be, and this easily could be the case, that AVG enabled its own protection, but there was left behind not the actual Norton protection, but just the label Norton in the registry somewhere, which is left behind. And so Windows labeled it Norton Firewall or Norton Anti-Worm Protection, even though it's not really, it's AVG's. I would get rid of AVG. I would get rid of everything you can, rerun the semantic uninstaller. This might be a case. I don't normally recommend registry cleaners, but this might be a case. I'll give you a good registry cleaner in a bit that I recommend. What else could you do? Go into the Windows firewall, make sure that that's turned off, I guess. Ultimately, you want it on. Windows firewall is more than adequate. If you've got a router, that's good protection, too. It's not a bad thing to have a router and the Windows firewall turned on, because Windows firewall is very lightweight. I'm not sure why these are interacting like this. And it's, frankly, sometimes it just gets into a mess. And all you can do is kind of bang at it, chip away at it, and hope that you can fix the problem. I don't have any particular recommendations. I do want to thank XP99 in the chat room, who sent us a link to annoyances.org, a place where you can customize your keyboard remapping. Hey, that's great. We'll put that in the show notes, too. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Thanks for being here. Stick around. And a good day to everyone in the Geek Nation. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. We're talking high tech at 888-88 Ask Leo. That's 888-827-5536. And tech is anything with a chip in it. It could be a cell phone, a camcorder, a home theater. Of course, computers and the internet, MP3 players, iPods, digital cameras. Love all that stuff. 888-8-ASK-LEO or 888-ASK. 88-88 Ask Leo. I like that. 88-88 Ask Leo. Are we sad about CompUSA? Companies struggling. They have 239 stores. Rumors are they're going to close almost half of them. That's a lot of stores. And while I was never, I use CompUSA because they're there. They're probably the nearest technology store in my area. In fact, I've got one, I'm equidistant between two of them. So maybe they'll close one and leave the other one open. I hope they're smart enough to do that anyway. But never the greatest store, but hey, there was some, at least it was there. And for some people who don't have an Apple store nearby, it might be the only retail place you could buy a Macintosh. They're facing, of course, online competition and competition from stores like Circuit City and even places like Walmart, the big stores who are selling computers and technology. I like the idea of being able to go to a technology store. It's kind of, you can look at all the different stuff. They're doing something wrong. According to the Consumerist, consumerist.com, which isn't always a bastion of truth, but a good gossip site on this stuff. According to Consumerist, they had $100 million in unsaleable inventory. What the heck could that be? 300 baud modems? I don't know what that was. But that's definitely a problem. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's tough to be a retail store in this industry. It changes so fast, you can't keep up with it. Today's cell phone is tomorrow's garbage. And an online store, they don't have to buy them. You put the order in, then they buy them and ship them to you. Often they don't even, they drop ship. They don't even touch the product. They act as a middleman. And I think more and more, certainly as people get sophisticated, they go online and they buy. And that's really what's hurting these stores more than anything. CompUSA has put up a list of, thanks to TTK in the chat room, has put up a list of the stores that will be closing. Wow. I'm just looking at it right now. It's a lot of stores. So I, my my uh, sympathies go out to the people who work at those stores and to the people who won't have those stores anymore to shop at. It's a tough business, the retail, the technology retail business. Hard for anyone to do well. Coming up in just a little bit, we're going to talk about hybrid DVD players. Now, you know, there's two standards. There's the high-def DVD, HD DVD, and there's Blu-ray. That's Sony's standard. They are incompatible. They compete with each other. Some movies are on one and not the other. It's a kind of a nightmare for a consumer who has a high-def TV and wants to watch one of these HD high-def DVDs. It has to choose. Well, maybe you don't have to choose. There's now a player from LG that does both. Scott Wilkinson, our audio-video expert, will join us in just a little bit to talk about the LG player. He has it. It's a little pricey, but he talks about whether it's worth getting. That's coming up. But let's get right back to the phones. 88-88-ASK-LEO, as I said, is the number to call. Brad, West Coast, California. Hello, Brad.
Hi, Leo. It's Brad. I enjoy the show.
Thank you, sir.
Quick question for you. I upgraded to Vista, and I have Outlook XP, you know, Office XP. But
how did that upgrade go for you? Because I have to say, more and more, I'm reading about people having problems with a Vista upgrade from XP, and I'm starting to think that that's something I'm going to stop recommending.
It wasn't easy. I ended up having to do it twice. The first time it did it. It installed it completely new, which must have been my fault, and it was just too difficult to get all the applications. So I did it again, and so far, the only problem I'm having is with this one thing with Outlook. But it did take me two installs to get it the way I need it.
So you had a backup and you restored your hard drive and then did it again.
Yeah, that's how I did it.
All the applications working, your data's still there, all of that stuff?
All the applications are working, data's still there. So from that aspect, it wasn't an issue. It just, I didn't realize that it was going to do a clean install versus an upgrade.
Right. It should have just said, okay, I see Windows there, I'm going to upgrade you. I'm not going to install on top of it.
All right. Yeah, for whatever
reason. Something to be aware of.
Yeah, for whatever reason, it installed it cleanly.
You said you're having trouble with Outlook. What's happening?
Well, when I go to Outlook, it prompts me for the password. I check the remember password.
Oh, yeah.
Next time, it just doesn't remember it.
Users. A common problem with Outlook. On XP, it was the same problem. I mean, it's not something new.
On XP, it worked fine.
Yeah, it's funny because I've heard of this problem many, many times on Outlook, forgetting its passwords. And you know, I'm sure it's going to happen on Vista, too. It's odd that the Vista upgrade did that to you. I have a feeling it has to do, Microsoft does have a support page on it, and I have a feeling it has to do with the registry key not being, you know, either being locked or not being saved. That's where it saves that password, by the way. So it's what Microsoft's recommendation is to actually either change the permissions on the registry or on the key or delete the key and start over. The key is, are you ready for this? I'll put this in the show notes. HKEY current user, software, Microsoft. That's always where the Microsoft stuff is. In this case, it's in the protected storage system provider. And look at the permissions in the security member. And generally, the recommendation Microsoft gives you is to reset the permissions. And make sure you do it on all the child objects. There's a checkbox there. So in other words, what's happening is Outlook's trying to save the password, but they can't do it. It can't do it because it doesn't have permission to. And as I said, it's not just a Vista upgrade that can cause this. In fact, this is the first time I've heard it happening with a Vista upgrade. It happens all the time in XP. If you want to look it up in the support note, it's Microsoft Knowledge Base article 290684. And we'll, of course, put a link in the show notes at techguylabs.com for you so that you can reference that yourself. Luke's in Oceanside, California. Hello, Luke. Welcome. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. I think you've been instrumental in me becoming a closet geek.
You're out of the closet now. A million people just heard. Oh, look at Oceans. He's a geek now. Welcome to the club. We'll send you the membership card and the special glasses and everything in the mail.
Oh, I can't wait. And my pocket protector.
Believe it or not, I'm joking about the glasses, but I do in fact send out pocket protectors to people. I buy them they're 17 cents each. I buy thousands at a time. They're the little twit pocket protectors. I think it's great. Everybody should have one. A little bit of masking tape for your glasses too. That's important.
Yeah, right on.
What can I do for you?
I've got a T-Mobile SDA smartphone.
Yep.
And I was successfully able to get it to sync with Microsoft Outlook with Business Contact Manager 2007 beta version, which I used last year when they released the beta.
Right.
Worked fine. I got it to sync up. I shouldn't say it worked fine. It took a little bit of tinkering to get it to work, but eventually it did. And now I have purchased the full version of
Office
that they just released, and I'm unable to get it to sync.
I have heard nothing but pain from people who are using Windows Mobile 5. That's what's on your SDA. And the new Microsoft, they don't use the old sync, the active sync. They don't use that anymore. Are you in Vista or are you in XP?
I'm in XP.
Now, I know Vista abandoned Active Sync. Does Office 2007 still use Active Sync, or does it on XP, or does it do this new thing? Business Connection thing, right?
Yeah, it's the I have the T-Mobile Active Sync program that worked with a beta version of Outlook 07, but apparently not with a new one.
What's happening? Is it not seeing it? Is it not syncing everything?
Just simply comes up a little error code that says attention and nothing, and you click on it, and it just indicates that nothing has synchronized. The computer recognizes the phone, but Outlook, for some reason, doesn't want to connect to Active Sync.
I have seen this complaint everywhere. Everywhere, and I don't know what the fix is. I think we have to wait until Microsoft releases a patch, because it's not working well. And I'd love to hear from somebody who has got Active Sync or whatever it is now that they call it for Office 2007 working with Windows Mobile 5, because I haven't tried it because I was very I'd heard all of these bad things, so I just kind of did not attempt it. But I've heard a lot of people complain about this, and I'm guessing it's something Microsoft's got to fix. I'm guessing that it doesn't work. But I'll tell you what, that's one of the reasons I love doing this show, because we have this vast audience of smart people. I'm sure somebody's tried it, either in the chat room at irc.dslextreme.com. You can join us in there. Or you can call 8888-ASK-LEO, or send me an email, leo@techguylabs.com. And I will see if we can figure out this thing. I had misgivings as soon as I saw that they were abandoning Active Sync. I thought, oh boy, sync is such a problem anyway. Oh boy. More of your calls coming up. 8888 Ask Leo. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Oh boy.
Hey,
you're up.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, from the Tech Guy Labs to your ears through the magic of radio. Now, there's technology. 8888 Ask Leo. We were talking about registry cleaners last hour, and I wanted to mention a couple of good ones. I don't recommend them, and if you've listened to me for any length of time, you know I'm not a fan. I find they cause more problems than they solve, but occasionally you need one. In this case, we had a caller who had a old install of Norton that he'd uninstalled, and then it was gone for a while. Then he installed a new antivirus, and all of a sudden it came back, and it's just it's a mess, and that's because you've got old registry keys hanging out. The registry was a bad idea, I'll be honest with you. I don't think anybody at this point thinks Microsoft did the right thing with the registry. It's a big lump of nothing. that actually a couple of files that more than two, I think, they appear as one file, but it's where all of the settings for programs, all the background information, a lot of Windows own settings are stored in this big binary file. You can't look at it. You have to use a registry editor. It's fragile. It can get bloated. It can get really big. And that's where these registry cleaners come in. The idea of going through it and saying, hey, you're not using that anymore. You're not using that anymore. Unless your registry is really bloated, however, I don't generally recommend that. But remember, I'm the guy who says you should reinstall Windows every 6 months to a year. I think of it as spring cleaning. I think that's the best way to clean your registry. Just start over. In the case where you've got this antivirus popping up again, you can use a registry cleaner. Fred Langa, who is a Windows expert, a guy I trust, he's got a great newsletter. It was the Langa list. Now it's part of the Windows Secret mailing list that Brian Livingston runs at windowssecrets.com. He recommends two. And since I don't use registry cleaners, I'm going to defer to him. He says, if you want a free one, Easy Cleaner. Small, simple, works well. He likes it a lot, and it's absolutely free. I'll put a link in the show notes because it's a Finnish address, and it's a long one for the internet site. But you could do a Google on Easy Cleaner, one word. And then he says the best one is not free, but it's worth buying. It's from Macecraft. It's the JV16 Power Tools, and you get a lot more than a registry cleaner. You get all sorts of useful stuff. It's $30. It's probably a good buy for anybody for a lot of things. Startup manager, registry cleaner, registry compactor. It's got a file organizer, duplicate file finder, disk wiper. I mean, just a lot of... This is a really good utility. It's free for 30 days, so if you just wanted to do that one task, you could do it, but I bet you'd want to buy it. I think it's very good. JV16 Power Tools at macecraft.com. And I would trust that. I mean, it's... Again, the issue is if you accidentally remove the wrong thing... Or even if you just trash your registry, it's notoriously fragile. You're going to have problems. You don't want to do that. Let's go to line five. It's Jim in Covina, California. Hello, Jim. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy.
Oh, hey, Leo. How you doing?
Great.
Long-time
how are you?
Long-time fan. Really
thank you.
Enjoy your show.
Thanks.
Hey, I usually download your podcast and listen to them on the train on my way to work. But listening today, my wife was... We were both listening, and she dialed up the phone to call. She said, if you could help me, maybe you could save me some money.
I'll do my best. Thanks to your
okay.
wife. Yes.
So I'm going through the regular pains of installing Vista. I currently have a Windows XP machine. I got two swappable SATA drives. And with my HP DVD burner, it works just fine under XP. And I bring it up under Vista, and it was working great. I had all my applications, all my hardware that I've upgraded to be ready for Vista. And then all of a sudden, when I go into my device properties, there's the little yellow asterisk next to the DVD burner, and it won't read it. And I get there's an error, and I'm sorry, I'm not right in front of the computer, but it says error starting device with an error code 10. And everything I've been able to find, it looks like there's some USB issues when you unplug USB devices without doing the safely remove. It can cause that, but I just haven't been able to figure out what it's doing.
It's an internal DVD burner, right? It's not an external drive.
It's an internal. Yeah, it's an HP DVD writer. It's just an IDE. It's on just an IDE.
And who makes the DVD burner?
It's an HP.
Oh, yeah, you said that. Sorry.
It's an HP 640i.
I'll start paying attention now. I would say you should go to the HP site, see if there's new firmware for the DVD burner. It sounds like there may be a compatibility issue. You know, the go ahead.
No, I was going to say there was a firmware update. It didn't say anything about Vista or compatibility or anything. My son actually has an 840, and I swapped it out to see if there's any difference, and it has the same problem.
That's good news, because what that means is, well, it could be good news. It probably means that the HP DVD burner is incompatible with Vista. Remember that Vista comes with drivers. It's a generic driver this is a standard SATA device or IDE device, so it should just use the standard drivers, but there can be incompatibilities at the hardware level, and this is one of the things we've been warning people about, frankly, with Vista. It's one of the reasons increasingly I'm starting to tell people you might want to think twice about upgrading from XP. If XP is okay for you, I'm not sure I'd recommend upgrading, and if you do, be prepared for these little weird, quirky things. So you haven't installed this new firmware?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't do the firmware.
I would do it. I would do it, even if it doesn't say this is for Vista, or doesn't say. You know, HP may be reluctant about disclosing that there's a problem, but it's interesting. I think it's very telling, in fact, that there is a firmware update for this burner. I would say that's the first thing you should try to do. Is there's no driver to update. You know, the XP has its drivers, but what you got to do is you've got to get the burner to work. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, coming up in just a bit. We're going to talk about these dual-format DVD players, both HD DVD and Blu-ray. Are they any good? Are they worth $1,200? Scott Wilkinson joins us. Stay here. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy from the Tech Guy Labs, 8888 Ask Leo. Coming up, I've got some suggestions from our chat room gang on maybe getting Windows ActiveSync to work better with a phone, some other solutions to other problems we've had. But right now, I want to talk a little bit about high-end audio and video with our main guy in the field, Scott Wilkinson. He is video editor for a fantastic magazine. One that you can get for free at avguide.com. It is the Perfect Vision magazine, and he writes about high-def TVs and more in there, and I love it that you can get this for free. Scott was at CES where, and I think this probably was the biggest product announcement at CES. LG announced for the first time a single player that would play both HD DVDs and Blu-rays. Do you have it, Scott? Have you had a chance to play with it?
I have, in fact, yes. It's actually a wonderful machine, the BH100. I love the way they do model numbers sometimes, you know. BH100, Blu-ray and HD DVD. It does, in fact, play both formats in the same player, and I'm thrilled every time I take a Blu-ray out and put an HD DVD in or the other way around.
But
it's just great.
$1,200.
Yes, $1,200 ain't cheap, I agree. But when you think about it, it is more expensive than the HD DVD players on the market today, although the top-of-the-line Toshiba is $1,000, so it's not that much more than that. On the other hand, it's actually less expensive than at least a couple of the Blu-ray dedicated right. players on the market. The Panasonic is $1,300 and the right. Pioneer is $1,500.
I guess if
and
you
this
really
play
want
both.
To watch both. You know, I ended up getting the HD DVD that came with the Xbox 360, so it only cost me a couple mm-hmm. $100. I have to say, I love the format. On a good high-def TV, it looks
yes.
fantastic.
Yes, it does look fantastic. I have loved HD DVD. They, of course, were the first ones out of the gate. Blu-ray came a few months later, and they stumbled pretty bad, Blu-ray did, with a problem in the first player, the Samsung player, and also some of the titles didn't look that good. Now, I've looked at a number of Blu-ray players since, and the title quality has come up, and the player quality has come up, and Blu-ray now looks pretty damn good. But I have to say, I just did a review not only of the LG, but of the new generation Toshiba HD DVD player, and I have to say, I'm still liking HD DVD picture quality, generally speaking, better than Blu-ray.
It's actually better?
Well,
I mean,
subjectively, from my, you know, just looking at a bunch of Blu-ray and looking at a bunch of HD DVD, I find myself being drawn more deeply into the HD DVD image, at least on good titles like King Kong, fabulous
oh,
title.
Oh, King Kong looks so good.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's just great.
In fact, it looked better than it did in the theater, I'll be honest with you. I saw stuff I never saw on the big screen.
Exactly. Now, I don't want to seem like I'm dissing Blu-ray, because I'm not. It's Blu-ray is a fine-looking format once you get past the initial titles. The first iteration of The Fifth Element, for example, just looked awful because they used a print that had dirt and scratches on it, and they put that on a Blu-ray disc.
Inexcusable.
What were they thinking?
Inexcusable.
It is. Completely inexcusable. But they've come a long way since then, and there are a lot of great titles that have come out recently. on Blu-ray. And the new Blu-ray players, the Philips I've looked at, the Panasonic and the Pioneer, all look great. The Pioneer in particular is a beautiful machine. But it's $1,500.
That's crazy.
You know,
would you recommend the LG? Would if I'm going to go out and buy a high def DVD player today?
I would, with a caveat, and the caveat is this: it does not have a complete HD DVD implementation. And the reason is, I'll tell you the reason. It started life as a Blu-ray player, and then LG said, "You know what? We'd really like to make a combo player," and so they added HD DVD onto it. But to get it out in a timely manner, they did not implement HD DVD's interactive functions, which are enabled by a language called HDI.
Blu-ray do many movies do this?
There are an increasing number of titles that do have this. But you can't do things, for example, like on a regular HD DVD player, you can call up a supplemental window, an inset window in the corner, sort of like PIP.
Right.
And you can have the director talking about things, or you can see the storyboard progression as the movie progresses. Personally, I don't deal with any of that stuff anyway. If I'm going to sit down and watch a movie, I want to sit down and watch the movie.
Right.
I don't want to be distracted by all that other stuff. But some people like to do it, so okay, that's fine. You can't do that with the with this LG player on HD DVD. On Blu-ray, everything is functional, completely functional.
Now, all the I guess the question is there going to be a dual format player that'll be cheaper and do all of this anytime in the next few months? Or
well, I have no doubt of that. LG has said that they're certainly going to come out with second generation. I asked them if a firmware update could add some of these HD DVD interactive features, and they said no.
Oh, dear. So you bought you bought it.
You bought it. Yeah. Uh-huh. However, I have to say that in my review of this player, in my conclusion, I said, anyone who can afford one and wants to have both formats capability, please buy one.
Right.
Because that will make sure, well, A, it'll send the consumer electronics industry a message saying, this is important.
Right.
Because this format war is so stupid.
It's so bad for consumers.
So bad for everybody.
Yeah.
Second of all, it will make sure that LG and others, you know, come out with combo players in the future that will be cheaper and have the full HD DVD interactive capabilities and so on. You know, this is the problem of all early adopters. You know, they really are beta testers and they're funding the development of future less expensive products. In this case, however, it's important. I think it's very important, and I would encourage anyone who has the scratch to help us all out and
kind of fund the market,
get this,
huh?
Exactly.
Yeah, all right, you buy it. I'll watch on the sidelines.
Yeah. But so, the performance of the Blu-ray and HD DVD performance of this player is fine.
It's just the HDI
movies
that
look
you're
great.
Missing.
That's just it's just the HDI that you're missing. That's correct.
If you had to pick a winner today, Blu-ray, HD, DVD, is it too early to tell? Is there one that's...
I think it is too early to tell. At CES, both camps held press conferences, and both of them declared victory.
Yeah.
Which is absurd.
A little premature, yeah.
A little premature. Both of them shipped about 150 titles last year. Both are expecting to ship about 300 titles this year. So I can't call a winner at this point. Blu-ray has a lot more industry support. Most of the consumer electronics manufacturers are making Blu-ray players. HD DVD players are still only being made by Toshiba, although they announced that there were going to be some Chinese companies and Onkyo who were going to be making HD DVD players. So Toshiba is no longer the only game in town, which is good news for them. It's too early to call a winner at this point, I think.
If you want to know more, Scott's got a great feature, a special feature in this month's edition of The Perfect Vision, Blu-ray Rising. Read all about it. And Scott's review of the LG dual format player. You can download a copy of The Perfect Vision magazine at avguide.com. It's absolutely free. I love that. I don't know why they're doing it, but let's encourage them to keep on doing it. A free magazine, I like it. But you can also get it on newsstands. And Scott joins us every week to talk about home theater and AV and all that stuff. He's an AV geek. But so am
no
I.
No doubt.
So it's okay. Thank you, Scott. We'll talk to you next week.
My pleasure.
You know, it strikes me. I'm just doing some math here. Thinking about this. If you bought a PlayStation 3 for, what is it, about $700. And that includes a Blu-ray player. And then you get a pretty good gaming system, right? So that's $700. You bought an Xbox 360. That's $400. That's $1,100. And you get, and then you add the $200 HD DVD add-on to that. So that's $1,300. That's about the same price as the LG, which I think is $1,299. So I think it's exactly the same price, but you also get gaming systems as well. Maybe that's if you really want to spend $1,200 or $1,300 so you can watch HD, DVD, and Blu-ray, just buy a PlayStation 3. In fact, I bet you they're going to be discounted. They're not moving very fast. Buy an Xbox 360. Buy the Xbox 360$200 HD DVD add-on, and boom, you got it all. And you got these great gaming machines. And you'd be the envy of all the geeks in your neighborhood. Tony, Houston, Texas. Hello, Tony. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Welcome.
Hello, Leo. How you doing?
I am great. I'm so glad you listened to the show. You found us.
I have a question for you. I'm sorry. I could barely hear you. You're coming real low.
Oh, I'm going to shout for you.
All right. Appreciate it. I have a question for you, right? Okay. I'm using a Mac G5 along with a Pro Tools recording system.
Yep.
And I wanted to know, okay, is it a wise idea to use the same, computer that I use for recording to serve the internet? Because I'm afraid of getting viruses if I go online.
I don't blame you, Tony. That's, of course, a concern. And, if you really wanted to be careful, and this is your livelihood, no matter what it is, whether it's you're a writer or whatever, it probably is a good idea to keep it off the internet. But I have to tell you, because you're on a Mac, it's particularly because you're on a G5, there are no viruses for the Mac. There's no spyware to speak of for the Mac. I think you don't have to worry about it. I mean, I would say, here's my advice to you. You could surf the net. You can look at web pages, especially if you're just looking at well-known sites. You're not going to be at any risk. I would be a little careful about downloading and installing shareware, free software. Don't go crazy about that. Not so much because it's dangerous, although that is a potential danger. More because it's just adding a lot of stuff to your system. And if you want Pro Tools to run at the absolute top speed, the less stuff you've got running on it, the better, the more. You don't want to fragment your hard drive. But I would say, if you were calling and saying this on a Windows machine, I'd say you bet stay offline, disconnected from the internet. But because you're on a Mac, I think you're actually very safe, and I don't think there's anything to worry about.
Okay, no problem. I appreciate that.
Hey, thank you, Tony. I'm glad you found us on KPRC in Houston, Talk Radio 950. It's really great to have listeners all over the country, all over the world. I'm really glad you listen, whether it's on your local station, on the internet, or on our podcasts. The show is available via podcast from the website, techguylabs.com, or from my main Twit site. Twit's where all my other podcasts are. TWI, Twit, it's self-deprecating. Everybody says, why do you call yourself a Twit? Because it stands for This Week in Tech, and that was the first podcast. Actually, the second podcast, first podcast I ever did was this show back in October of 2004. And then Twit shortly after that. And now I think I'm up to almost a dozen podcasts at TWIT. Those are all shows. If you don't know what a podcast is, that you can download from the internet. You can listen on the website. There's a little player on there if you go there. Or you can download them and listen to them on your computer or on an MP3 player like an iPod. Or you could even subscribe to it and get it automatically when there's a new show. So there are a couple of ways you can listen. More of your calls coming up. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, the waning moments of this fabulous radio program, but fear not, I will be back. I always am, like a bad penny, you can't get rid of me. 8888, ask Leo is the number. Mike B. in our chat room says he's been using Windows Mobile 5, it is synced just fine in Vista with Office 2007. A number of other people said they've had no problems in XP with Office 2007 and Windows mobile phones. But they do suggest, and I think I should have said this, it's a good idea, to delete the existing or the original partnership in ActiveSync and create a new partnership so that it will use these new features of Office 2007. I love Office 2007, I have to say. In fact, I think in many ways it's a more significant release than Vista is. I mean, this new ribbon bar is a very clever solution to a very tough problem. The complexity of software today is so great that they have to put in all these features, right? And most of us use a small fraction of the total features in, let's say, Microsoft Word. The research I've seen says it's typically 5%, one feature in 20. So how do you make all these features available and still make the program so it's not overwhelming the user, so that, you know, just the stuff they want is there? And I think the ribbon, the new tool ribbon that they've used in lieu of menus, is a very, very good choice. I was very skeptical at first. When I first saw it, I thought, oh, they're crazy. Why would they change a user interface that everybody has trained, you know, their brain, it's written in their brain how to use it. But it didn't take me long to figure it out. It's the first time I think that's been worth upgrading it to a new version of Office in three or four versions. Frankly, if you were using Office XP, there was not a compelling reason to go to Office 2003. No. But I think there is a good reason to go to 2007. Absolutely. Justin in Lake Forest, California. Welcome. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. I got a big problem here.
Okay. Everybody does. That's why they call me.
I've been a Mac user, for 15 years. I finally got off the OS 9 system at Christmas time and bought a new Mac Pro.
Holy cow.
I've been creating all my documents in Microsoft Word and using old versions of Word, probably 2002 or 3. And when I got my computer guy put on the latest version of Microsoft Word. And what's happened is the fonts don't match up. In other words, the new courier... there's more spacing between the letters and there's more spacing between the lines. And what it has done when I did the transfer over of all my old information, all my documents, every document I've created is out of whack and askew. I'm losing like 7 lines per page or bouncing down. Is there a way to go back to my old... I still have my old Microsoft Word program on my old computer. Is there any way to import just one or two files over into... the new Microsoft Word, so I could use the old fonts that work okay?
You know, that's a really interesting question, and I'm wondering what exactly is going wrong here. You think it's the fonts?
I know, for instance, on my old program, if I bolded a line, the line would get longer because of the bold.
Yep.
And I think in the new design of the new Microsoft Word,
so it doesn't.
When you bold a line, it stays the same length because I can see visually there's more space between each letter to allow for that.
They're smarter. They're changing the leading, so it will intentionally. And that's good typesetting, frankly. That's improving the typesetting.
Well, I've tried, you know, changing the line spacing with the leading, and that can tighten up pages. But I've created I'm in the music biz, and I have a lot of those round CD labels. I literally probably 700 or 800 of them.
Now, let me ask an obvious
off the margin.
Let me ask an obvious question. You did go to page setup and select the printer and because you know it has the old page setup in there. You need to on that document go to page setup and say, hey, I'm doing this now again, and it will often fix some of the formatting issues. If they're true type fonts, they should be movable. They could just come over,
I could bring an old font in.
And you should be able. I don't think there's any reason why. It depends on which version of Office you were using. It doesn't sound like you were using that old a version, which means you should be able to move it to OS 10. If it was an OS 9 specific version of Office, it won't run well on 10. It won't run at all on 10. But if it was a Carbon version designed to work on both, it will work. But I would try taking the old fonts over. My suspicion is that Word was updated to do letting properly. I mean, that's what a typesetter does. A typesetter is aware of the overall look of the line, and when something is bolded, it says, you know, it adjusts for that. That's called letting. And it sounds like it might be doing a better job. So either go back to the old. I mean, in other words, it's not. I don't know if it's the font issue. Frankly, I think it might be the program. Very an interesting question. I'd love to know if anybody who has a expertise in prepress or anything like this has a solution for us. I'd love to hear. Let me see if it squeezes one in. Before the end of the show, Shane's in New York City. Hello, Shane. How are you? Welcome.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
Great.
I have a question for you.
Yep.
I just switched over to the Mac. Got a Mac Pro, and I want to know if I can sync using mail.app between two Macs using the Mac system, or do I need to get an IMAP email service?
The .Mac does not sync mail. It syncs the signatures. It'll sync the keychain. It'll sync the accounts, but it won't sync the messages. However, you can do what you want. You basically want to see the same mail on two machines. You can do that by telling mail, when you download the mail, don't clear it off the server. You can do this with any email application. This is, by the way, why I use IMAP. The idea behind IMAP, most of the time you're an internet service provider, most mail services are using something called POP3, Post Office Protocol 3. And the way that works is when you check your mail, it downloads it from the server, deletes it on the server. IMAP, it stays on the server. Mail.app or whatever you're using, Outlook, is just looking at a view of the mail. And so it's the same on all machines. You can kind of simulate that by saying, when you download the mail, don't delete it. Wait a week or two, then delete it. You don't want to leave it there forever because your ISP will get angry at you. You don't have unlimited storage there. But wait a while and then delete it. And that'll give you time on all your machines. You can do it with many machines to download the same mail. That'll give you the same mail. It's not exactly the same because, for instance, your sent mail folder is not duplicated. So if you send it on one machine, it won't show up on the other machine in your sent mailbox. I use fastmail.fm. They're an IMAP company. It's very inexpensive. And frankly, that's why I do, because I have many different machines, Windows and Mac. I use Outlook or Apple Mail or a variety of a Thunderbird of other programs to look at my email. It's the same everywhere, folders and everything. Out of time. I'll be back soon, though. Don't go away. Leo Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy. So glad you joined us. Have a great day. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to hear the show live, check your local listings or visit our website, leo.am, for a list of stations where you can hear the Tech Guy radio show live on the air. You can also hear archived shows at leo.am and subscribe to our podcast there, or open your podcasting client and subscribe to the feed at leo.am/podcasts/KFI. Thanks to Howard Bailey for the music for this podcast. You can find more of Howard's work at soundclick.com. Thanks to Premier Radio Networks for syndicating the show. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. This is Leo Laporte. I'll see you next time on The Tech Guy.